and welcome to Backchat with Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up in Preston, and Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire and our listeners in Swindon. You can also access the show on radioforall.net. I'm Kirsty Paul.
I'm James Melia.
And I'm Kay Sangandaffy. Coming up in the show.
I also experienced a very militarized culture, a culture that was completely caught up with aggressive military might, more so than anything I had ever experienced before or since.
A Jewish American, Naomi Woodspring, speaks up against Zionism.
Now, to explain to the world and also to the Israelian, we are ready to die there. We live there all over the history. And now we're ready to die in our lands. And more than 60 years without our lands, 63 years. And all the time we wait for the justice.
More about the displacement of the Bedouin farmers from their homeland. We're going to hear a track by Andy Williams called The House of Bamboo.
Number 54, a house with a bamboo door, bamboo roof and bamboo walls, they've even got a bamboo floor. You must get to know Soho Joe, he runs an espresso called the House of Bamboo. It's made of sticks, sticks and bricks, but you can get your kicks in the House of Bamboo. In this casino, you can drink a chino when it's gotcha, swing it to the cha-cha, dance the bolero in the sombrero and shake. I like a snake. You want it dropping when the cats are hopping. Let your 2 feet move to the big beat. Pick yourself a kitten and listen to a platter that rocks. The jukebox, I'm telling you, when you're blue, well, there's a lot to do in the House of Bamboo. You've got to know Soho Joe, he runs an espresso called the House of Bamboo. In this casino, you can drink a chino, let your 2 feet move to the big beat. Pick yourself a kitten and listen to a platter that rocks. I'm telling you, when you're blue, well, there's a lot to do in the House of Bamboo. Number 54, the house with the bamboo door, bamboo roof and bamboo walls, they've even got a bamboo floor in the House of Bamboo.
That was House of Bamboo by Andy Williams. Bamboo is effective protection against the rain, but unfortunately not against the cold. Our next two guests are more concerned with the upkeep of bricks and mortar.
We come to our first studio guests, who are here to talk about buy-to-let landlords. Nadil, how did you get into buy-to-let agency?
Quite an interesting story. I think around when I was at the age of around 17, I dropped from college and my dad said, you must go out, don't return back until you get yourself a job. So I was actually an apprentice working for a letting agency at the time.
And how did you find it at first?
Instantly, I kind of knew this was something I wanted to progress myself in terms of a career. So once I started meeting property landlords, I thought, right, this is something I want to be. It became quite early stage, quite apparent that this is what I want to do.
And what were you doing at first?
Prior to that, I was a few part-time jobs working in Quicksave, Dillon's, a lot of the local convenience stores, and then went to pursue a career for education. And at that time, that's where I realised education for me at that time wasn't the best way forward. It was hands-on work.
And then when did you get the idea that you wanted to run your own agency?
2009, the recession come in and I'd realised that I'm going to be working very hard for my current employer at the time. I was a manager for a local company. I'd realised that with the recession coming in, my income is probably not as great as my outgoings, so I thought this is the time for me to take the leap and set up my own agency.
We've also got a Chris Worthington in, and he's a buy-to-let landlord from many years. So what was it like for you?
Hi. Well, I'm actually here with Adil because Adil is the agent for managing a property that I own in Bristol and has been for quite a number of years. So I think it's fair to say we know each other quite well. But being a buy-to-let landlord, in many ways, is like any other business. You need to look after your customers, in other words, tenants. You need to provide a quality product. You need to be willing to invest. And you need to keep an eye on the finances.
So how have you found Adil?
Adil's great, yeah. We've just done a renovation, quite a major renovation, of the house that I own in eastern Bristol. We've got some very good tenants. And I hope that will stand us in good stead, you know, for a year or two.
Okay, so for your letting agency, what kind of stuff do you do now? What's the letting agency like?
Predominantly, there's a couple of services that we offer our landlords. We have some landlords who'd actively want to manage the day-to-day affairs of their own properties. So in which case, we'd find them the tenants, do the references, collect the first month's rent, deposit, set them in, move them into the premises, and then the landlord would take over from there. The other service, which Mr. Worthington has got with us, is the full management service, where we would deal with the day-to-day runnings of the property.
Chris, why did you think you wanted a deal for the job?
He was covering the area where my house is based, and he was actually recommended to me by another agent, another letting agent. For some reason, didn't want to take it on, but anyway, they didn't. So,
few properties. That you...
It's something I found myself involved with rather than really setting out to do it. No, I did have three over a period of 10 to 15 years. I sold one last year, so I now have two, but it's gone very well. It has its ups and downs. I mean, some years are better than others. And the return on buy-to-let property is probably, on the investment, is probably not as much as many people think.
Adil, have you found that there's ups and downs as well?
I think there's always a lot of challenges. I think with the market that we're in, obviously having gone through the recession, we did see a lot of landlords, you know, go under, in which case only the landlords that are professional and have got a mindset that they're happy to do works to a property to bring it up to today's spec, they're definitely the winners.
And have you found there's a few letting agencies around Bristol?
We're seeing every day a letting agency opens up, probably more so now that I'm a letting agency owner myself. But I think the last count I had was there's probably around 154 agents in around the Bristol area.
Yeah.
So it's quite a competitive market.
And how do you kind of distinguish your letting agencies? Advertising like the best way, or how Chris was recommended, so just being good?
I mean, in most cases, we can never knock the recommendations, so a lot of our landlords would always recommend other landlords to us. Once they receive our service, they're obviously happy and hence they're ready to recommend somebody to us. But predominantly, we use a lot of the major advertising portals such as Rightmove, Zoopla, findaproperty.com. And again, landlords looking for the rental values in that specific area will then stumble across us and then give us a call and say, look, we've got a property, we've noticed you've got something similar, do you think you could help us?
And Chris, are your properties in Bristol solely? Or
there's one in Bristol and one in Tooting in London.
And have you found the differences between them?
The London rental market is very buoyant. If you're a landlord, rents are increasing, as they are in the rest of the country. They're probably going up fast in London than elsewhere, and capital values are starting to edge up. Having said that, I mean, the background to that is that there is a chronic shortage of housing in this country, which means that there are opportunities there for buy-to-let landlords. If you can raise the money or if you can get a mortgage on a new property, it's probably not a bad investment at the present time. But I mean, I think the wider issue, which we probably can't go into, is there is a chronic shortage of housing.
And Adil, how have you found Bristol for letting compared to other places?
To be fair with you, ever since I've been in the industry, I've always been covering the Bristol area. We have had landlords recently approach us for properties that they're marketing in around Newport, Weston, which just as a goodwill gesture, we have let their properties for them. So, I mean, in general, I would say Bristol, because of Cabot Circus and the employment that we have got here, generally I do find that the property market is quite active, so if the property is vacant and it is up together, there is a high chance of you being able to fill that.
And what are your ideas for the company in the future?
I think one of our things sort of progressing forward is trying to see what we could do which is slightly different to a lot of the other competitors that we've got out there. So one of the things we've been focusing on is property training, so education for landlords or first-time investors before they go out and purchase a property. We've got classes where we send these people to and they could attend. We hold monthly events. And if somebody's interested, we'd give them a hands-on approach in terms of selecting a property and advising them where they would be able to make their yields.
And aside from the letting side, but actually having your own business and running everything yourself, what's it like compared to being employed by somebody?
I think the realisation that the buck stops with you always keeps you on your toes. I think I'm very proud in what I do, and I would be very embarrassed if there was a situation and it come to me and I wasn't able to tackle it. You know, we do have challenges in the business, but I think what, again, separates you is how you deal with them.
Yeah, I would say if you're thinking about being a buy-to-let landlord or making an investment in property and you're new to it, I would recommend getting some advice. And Adil mentioned the property options seminars, which he's running in Bristol with some colleagues once a month. And I've been along to some of those, and they're very useful. So I would recommend going to that source of advice.
Do you have a website?
We do have a website. The website address is www.letsrentbristol.co.uk.
Well, thank you both of you for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks fair to Adil Ayoub and Chris Worthington.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go round, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a nice entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ting-a-ling for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht. What? Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes us go round, of that we both are sure, on being poor. Money, 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 money.
You need, of course, money to take part in the buy-to-let scheme, even if it's only for a deposit put down on the property. Our next guest is here to talk about the Troodos Banking Group. So welcome now to Jane Clark, Head of Marketing.
Hello, Jane.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Troodos Bank is, as you understand it, a sort of European-wide ethical bank.
Yes.
And you deal in sort of quite a bit of retail banking, is that correct?
Yeah, what we offer in the UK is retail banking, business banking, and also investment banking and some corporate finance as well. I think probably the retail banking side is most interesting to people.
And you're based in Bristol, is that correct?
We are. The UK head office is here in Bristol. We used to be based up in Clifton, but now we have some new offices next to the Environment Agency on Deanery Road by the library, which are fantastic. And we're lucky to have some beautiful offices that have been built to really high sustainable grading. So we're really proud of them from that point of view as well.
So is that a big sort of part of what Troodos are looking at, the sort of sustainability side of banking, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I think when we try to describe ourselves, we don't know whether we should be describing ourselves as an ethical bank or whether we should be describing ourselves as a sustainable bank. And I think we are both, and I think it depends on what hook people are more interested in. I would say that we're sustainable from the point of view of how we run the bank. We run a very traditional banking model, which probably differentiates us from most other banks in the UK, where we take people's money in for their savings and then we lend it out. And the difference that we charge in interest on those is how we make our money and how we make our profit. So from that point of view, we're sustainable. Ethical, probably because we only lend money to organisations and companies and charities that do something positive for the environment, either culturally, socially, or environmentally. So in that way, I suppose we would be classed as ethical. And we also describe ourselves as transparent, which I think in banking these days is a term that not many other banks can use. And that's because we tell our savers where we invest their money, and we're very open about that. And we publish a whole list of everyone that we lend to every year. And we also have a website where people can put their postcode in and see where the money is invested nearby.
So why just try to go down the banking route as opposed to, say, the building society route? First of all, what's the difference between the two? In my mind, I've always associated the more sort of ethical side of money with building societies rather than banks.
Yeah, and I think that historically probably was more true. And I think with building societies, they used to have a more simplistic model where they would, again, take people's savings in and then invest it in people's mortgages. So it was quite a simple thing. That's what they did. And they were normally owned, most of them are mutual, so they were normally owned by people rather than by shareholders. I think Nationwide probably would be an example. But they've started to change a little bit more now, again, Nationwide as an example, to become more like banks. But what we wanted to do, we wanted to lend money. We wanted to make money work for good. And so to do that, we wanted to do it in a wider arena than just investing in houses and mortgages. We wanted to be able to invest in farming and renewable technology and energy and things like that. So we wanted to be a bit broader. I think the term bank is probably deemed as being a little bit of a bad word, but society needs banks in order to grow and to be where they are. And we all use banks. And so even though it's sort of deemed as a bit of a bad word, we felt that we should be a bank rather than anything else.
So if I was someone coming along to your bank looking for investments, you'd probably look at the business case like any good bank would. And then you'd also look for some kind of sort of sustainable or ecological or something like that on top of just whether we're going to pay the money back.
Absolutely. And I think it's a balance of both. I think some people think that because we are a sustainable bank that we only look at the sustainability of a project, but we don't. We're a bank and we're investing people's money that they've lent to us. So we have to ensure, number one, that that company is going to meet the loan repayments when it comes down to it, basically. So we have to make sure that the business case is right. I think we're very lucky that we work in specific sectors and we have a lot of expertise in the business of people who know those sectors, organic farming, for example, or renewable energy. People who've worked in it for sort of over a decade. And so we know what a good business case looks like in those industries because we have the expertise in it. And we also are able to help those farmers to build a business case as well because we have that expertise. So it works from both points of view.
And has it helped that businesses in those sectors are actually in real growth sector at the moment?
Yes, it is. I think we're very lucky. We have a very, very low default on our loans. But it's not just down to luck. It's also down to, as I said, to us knowing the sectors and making sure that we're investing in companies that we know are going to work.
So if I wanted to go down to my local branch of Charles Bank, could I open a current account there and start banking with you? And if so, what are the advantages to doing that rather than going to sort of one of the big four?
Well, we don't offer current accounts for personal customers as yet, which is a shame, but we are planning on doing it and we're hoping to do it quite soon. But we do offer a whole range of savings accounts for personal customers, which is a great way of being introduced to the bank as a whole. And it's also something we can do a lot more with your savings than we can do with your current account. And so it's quite nice to know that your savings are being invested in that way. What we offer very competitive interest rates. We offer ISAs. We offer every sort of savings account that you would want. We don't have branches, unfortunately, though everyone who lives in Bristol are lucky that we do have the only branch here in the UK is here in Bristol. So you can come in and see us there. And one of the main things that we offer is, well, A, the knowledge that your money is being used sustainably, that you're supporting an ethical bank, which in these days it makes a lot of our customers very proud. And thirdly, that you know where your money's being invested, and there's no other commercial bank in the UK that can offer you that knowledge. So you can go onto our website, put in your postcode, and see where our lenders are near your house. So you could see that the farm down the road or the nursery or the housing unit is being invested in your ISA money, and no other bank can offer you that.
So if anyone would like to find out a bit more about the bank or even open an account or something like that, how do they go about that?
Well, the easiest thing to do is to go to our website, triodos.co.uk, or give us a call and or pop in and see us. We are here in Bristol and we welcome people coming in to see us as well. Okay. But the website is definitely the best place to go to choose an account.
Perfect. Thank you, Jane.
Okay, thank you.
That was Jane Clark, Head of Marketing at the local Triodos Bank.
Here we have Naomi Woodspring.
I thought it'd be really helpful to give people some background, and my personal feeling is that the Israelis have made a decision that they want a land with no Palestinians in it. They want utter and total control of Israel. And despite the way that the government was structured when statehood happened in 48, the promises that were made in 1948, they've all been broken, and there doesn't appear to be any political will in Europe or in America to enforce what's all been promised before. And of course, as you know, I mean, the UN keeps cranking out these reports saying war crimes are happening. This is outrageous situation. They don't use the word outrageous, but the UN cranks these reports out, and yet there's no political will or put in force any kind of measures that would stop the Israelis from, I don't want to use the word genocide because it's not a question so much of killing Palestinians, which, yes, they do, but that's only one tactic. Taking water, taking land, making life untenable. It's death by a thousand cuts.
And you said agriculture is only 2% of...
2.6%.
The Palestinian workers in other fields, how are they treated?
You know, I really don't know about that. I do know that in years past, before about 10 years ago, there were Palestinians working in quite a number of sectors in Israel. And at this point, Israeli business does not want to use Palestinian workers in general. They do want to use Palestinian workers in agriculture, just like we use migrant workers in America and Europe, because it's dirty, back-breaking, miserable work. But other kinds of work could be done by Israelis in other sectors. And I certainly believe that a boycott, and the official word on the boycott, is not just boycott Israeli produce, Israeli agricultural goods, Israeli goods across the board.
And how do you think Israel will react to that?
That's a really interesting question. You know, before I came on the radio, I got really curious about how is Israel reacting to that, something I hadn't actually thought much about. And I did look up one site that, when I Googled Israel's reaction to the boycott, which was, it was really, the rhetoric was shockingly aggressive, I think is the only word I could use. What it said on the site was that the boycott is the first step to another Holocaust, which it's irrational. It's a statement that is so irrational and so designed to just whip up emotion. It makes no sense. You know, I should mention here that I am Jewish, and I have been to Israel as a Jew. I come from a family where everyone in my family, of course, you know, we were Russian Jews. We had to leave Russia because of the pogroms. My family emigrated to America. And not only I very much stand in solidarity with Palestine, but a number of years ago, my mother wrote a letter that she sent to the Israeli Knesset telling them that she no longer wanted her right of return and she would like them to give it to a Palestinian.
And how do you think the situation with Israel will change in the future?
How do I hope? It's unimaginable to me. It's a deeply, deeply racist country, deeply, profoundly entrenched in an ideology that is unsustainable. I can only hope that, or is it hope? Yeah, I guess. I can only hope that solutions come in ways that no one in this studio right now can imagine, but solutions come out of the imagination of the best of Israelis and the best of Palestinians to create some kind of equity, some kind of life for Palestinians, and some kind of peaceful coexistence.
And going back to you, why did you want to visit Israel?
Well, I didn't particularly want to visit Israel, but it was a deal that when I was a young woman, that if I went to Israel, my father would pay for the rest of my trip to Europe. So I went to Israel, and I worked on a kibbutz for, I think I lasted a day and a half, and I didn't like it at all. I went to Jerusalem and ended up meeting a group of Palestinian-Israeli hippies. This was in 1969. And we all took LSD together, and we got along famously.
Were you always, I don't want to say pro-Palestinian or anything, but like agreed with the
yes.
Palestine, or was there something that changed your mind?
Well, I come from a very interesting activist family, and my grandfather was very anti-Zionist. So I did know that there was something wrong with the Zionist mythology growing up. But then going to Israel when I was 19 and seeing it was so racist. It was so unbelievably racist there. And I was hearing really horrible remarks, not just made toward Palestinians, but also made toward Sephardic and Falashi Jews. And Sephardic Jews are Jews who come from Spain, who come from Turkey. And Falashi Jews are African Jews. So European Jews were saying really terrible things about Sephardic and Falashi Jews. So I experienced that. And I also experienced a very militarized culture, a culture that was completely caught up with aggressive military might, more so than anything I had ever experienced before or since. And finally, I think the other piece of it was, as I said, meeting young people who, like me, were part of the 60s culture, who were Palestinian and Egyptians and a couple Israelis. And it cemented any kind of idea I had that Zionism was okay.
And afterwards, did you look into it?
When in 1969, there was no pro-Palestinian movement. There was no activism. I came back to America and told people about what I had experienced, and they just thought I was crazy. And people in my own family who were Zionists were pretty nasty to me that I could say these things, think them, but then, say them out loud. And there's been quite a rift with a number of members of my own family because of my politics. But over the years, of course, more people began to recognize what was going on in Israel and form organizations. But in 1969, nothing was shaking.
Those members of your family, had they visited Israel? Had the kind of racism just gone past them?
Yeah. You see what you want to see. You hear what you want to hear. You know what you want to know. We all do that. I think if we were aware of all the injustice on the planet, we couldn't live. We couldn't tolerate living. So all of us have kind of what would I call it? Oh, specific seeing, specific knowing. And if you choose a Zionist perspective, then you choose to not see the injustice there. You may well see the injustice somewhere else.
When did it start to be kind of activism anti-Zionist kind of.
Before World War II, there was an anti-Zionist movement, and right after World War II, and then, of course, as I said, it didn't exist when I was a kid. Sometime in the 80s, people started talking about what was going on, and by the early 90s, now, this is in the States, because I wasn't living in the UK then, so I don't know what was going on here. But by the early 90s, things were really beginning to organize in the States. And it's interesting because there's a real difference in the movement here and in the U.S. In the U.S., it's primarily Jews who were the first people involved in organizing. Of course, Palestinians were always trying to organize. Yeah. Palestinians who are refugees who had to leave Israel and ended up in the U.S. But in terms of people who weren't Palestinians, it was the Jews who began to organize in the U.S. And here in the U.K., it's very different because you have a history of colonization. You have the Balfour Agreement. So there's a different consciousness about the history of Israel and a different kind of guilt about the history of Israel.
Due to
exactly, exactly.
Creation.
Yeah.
And do you have many contacts in Israel and the surrounding area?
No, I don't. I don't. I know a number of Israelis who have left Israel because they found it untenable to live there, and particularly people who have children who have left because they've chosen to raise their kids in a whole different environment and a different culture, and also because they didn't want their children to be in the military, and there is universal service in Israel.
And have you revisited Israel?
No. And will I go back? No.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You heard Naomi Woodspring talking about Zionism.
My name is Dr. Awad Abu Freh.
You're from Palestine?
Yes, I'm from Palestine. I'm a Palestinian, from the Palestinian who live in Israel now.
And you've come over to Britain to tell people about the plight of the villages?
Yes. We feel all the time that the world hear about the Palestinian who live in Gaza or the Palestinian who live in West Bank or in Jerusalem. But our story, nobody know. We are living in our land, in our villages. We still stay in the land which occupied in 1948, not 1967. We still there in our lands. We were there thousands of years. And we became Israelian because we have the passport. I'm a citizen of Israel, but I'm a Palestinian. We are a Bedouin living in the Negev. And now we're suffering all the time because the Israelian destroy our homes, our villages. We live in unrecognized village, and we live without conditions, without water, without electricity, anything. But we live in our land, and we are a farmer. Now they take our land. We can't use our land. We can't live like Israeli citizen. We can't. We also, one thing we can do to leave, the Israelian want us to leave the Negev, the Nakab in Arabic, to leave the Nakab to maybe to Jordan or to Egypt. But we were there all the time over the history. This is our land, and we have the documents that we have a permit from British, when the mandate from Turkey, the Ottoman period, the Ottoman time, we were there, and they give us the recognition, and the British give us also the recognition, but the Israelian, but I think it's very, very difficult now to explain to the world, and also to the Israelian, we are ready to die there. We are ready, we live there all over the history, and now we're ready to die in our lands. And more than 60 years without our lands, 63 years, and all the time we wait for the justice. Maybe every year we hope that we will have justice and we maybe return to our lands. But now we know there's no justice in Israel. Israel is racism. We feel the discrimination. We feel the apartheid, a new apartheid now in the Negev. We feel the rules of army colonial rules against us. And now we tell everybody in the world, till now we are unviolent people. Our struggle all the time, we say everybody in the world, also in our sons, in our new generation, we are no violent. We are civilians. But I think that the new generation, it will be different. I think the new generation now very, very angry.
Can you tell listeners one really shocking point, and that is that the Israeli government have wiped your villages off the map? You're not registered, are you?
I think it's very usual for me. I'm not surprised, because the Israelian want to clean the map from the name of the Arabs, not only in the Negev and all of Israel. There is a law, new law, have to write in the map only Jewish names.
They want to wipe you off the face of the earth.
Yeah, this is what the, I think that the plan of Sharon, and the Sharon, you know, Arik Sharon, who's a big commander and the prime minister of Israel, to Judaize the Negev, and Judaize the names, and the man, and the human, everything. And now there's one, maybe one enter the war against us, the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, work together with the old authorities. Now the JNF take our land. They took our land. They said, like, they lease the land from the Israeli Land Authority. This is our land with very big forest. They changed the names. They changed the valleys. They changed the hills. Now I can't understand. I can't recognize my land because the land now changed. Everything changed. And now only some of the villages, Bedouin village, you can see in the map. My village, Al-Araqib, you can't find it in the Israeli map. We know that this is a war against the collective memorial. They want us to forget everything, to forget our source, where we come from, our names, our valleys. But I think it will not happen.
The Israeli government are stealing your land, so they're criminals.
This is against human rights, clearly. Israeli, I think it's know that. We were in the UN. We send a lot of letters to the UN Committee of Human Rights and to the ambassadors in the world. Israel said all the time, the law is the Israeli law. This is our land, and all the lies that Israeli now tell the world. This is a criminal war. There is a war from the state against its own citizens. This is a war against us, and we are Israeli citizens. I don't choose to be Israeli, because we were there all the time. But when Israel established in 1948, we stay there. The Israeli push us out. We stay only 10% still in the lands. And now the Israeli take our land and make all the problems. And they know this is against the human rights in the world. They know, but they never mind.
What's happening about the human rights and the UN?
Maybe they do something, but not enough. They protest, but not enough. Unless the European and America stop the supporting blind. I think this is the problem of us, that the Israeli know all the time we are in the East, but all the West is with us, and America is also with us. And the simple people in America, simple people in Britain here, and the simple people maybe in all Europe know nothing, I think. Only they hear the one side, the story of the Israeli. But what about our side? We are human. I'm a man, and I want to live in my land, and I have a lot of children, and I have a dream, and I want my people also have a dream like all the others. We want to live in dignity like all the others in the world. All the others in the world, all the world now have to know, in Israel, if you are not Jews, you can't live. If you are not Jews, you can't have a water.
But what about the Jewish people? Don't they feel some kind of guilt about what they're doing to you?
In Israel, there is some of Jewish people who work with us against the policy of their government. And in the world also, I feel that the Jewish people have feel something to correct the government of Israel. But I think it's not enough. The Israelian now make a lot of mistake, you know, after Gaza war and after all that happened now in the West Bank and against Lebanon and now against their citizens. If they continue in their policy, it's dangerous for them, and it's dangerous for all the others, and also dangerous for all the world.
A plea on behalf of farmers in the Negev area of Israel, talking about the forced displacement of their people. A song from the Blind Boys of Alabama. It's called Way Down in the Hole.
to the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon for the stealing their sack. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be safe from Satan when the thunder rolls. You gotta keep the devil.
Subject of blindness, let's hear all about the new technology that helps blind people to use computers adapted to help blind or partially sighted people.
Okay, so my name is Scott Wood, and I'm the Senior Technology Coordinator, and I work for an organisation called Action for Blind People, and I work in Bristol, and we have a big office where we run services for blind and partially sighted people. And part of this, the work that I do is in our Action Technology Training Suite, where we have facilities for training blind and partially sighted people in how to use computers. So as you can imagine, using a computer for somebody who's got sight problems or sight loss of any degree is going to cause difficulties. And our job is to train people who are blind and partially sighted in the use of that technology so they can lead more independent lives and improve their communication skills and get employment if they so wish. We've equipped the centre with new computers, iPads, iPhones, all the sorts of technologies that you can imagine that people use today. But that's not the end of it. As you know, technology is never ending and never ceasing and always needs updating and maintaining. So we've launched something called the ICANN Appeal, which is an appeal run by the RNIB, who are our sister charity. And the ICANN Appeal was launched specifically to raise funds for the Action Technology Training Suite, which we run in Bristol, to upgrade equipment as and when we need to, and to engage a part-time member of staff who would be solely dedicated to running the centre and training the students. We're very lucky because in the centre we have 11 volunteers at the moment who work with us, and so we're able to reach more people than if it was just me on my own. So we offer training to blind and partially sighted people in the Bristol area or from wherever they want to come from. I've got one lady who's coming from Cirencester. Such is the demand out there for this kind of training. We launched the Action Technology Training Suite, or the ATS as we call it, back in October. Got leaflets, we got websites. So we've already helped train over 50 people now. There's a great demand out there and we haven't really touched the surface. With iPhones and iPads and that type of technology, the Apple technology, it's all built in. That anybody owns an iPhone or an iPad or an iPod could actually switch this technology on if they knew what to do. And that's where we come in with the training. It's very simple. With an iPhone, there's a home button on the bottom. If you click it three times, it turns the speech on. So it starts speaking to you. If you learn the gestures and the ways that you move around the screen and touch the screen, you can learn to use that using speech. So everything on the screen is spoken out to you, so you know what's going on. With all due respect to Microsoft, actually, I've been using Microsoft products in my working life since the early 90s. And at that time, Apple wasn't anywhere near that stage. Because of its more open source nature, third parties were able to build technologies that were available to us to make the computers work. So even though Microsoft have been tardy in introducing their own accessibility features, they've made it possible for other people to do that, whereas Apple is very closed and doesn't let people do that necessarily. So Microsoft have given me employment for quite some time, and lots of other blind and partially sighted people. And I have to say that in their latest operating system, which is Windows 8, there's a very reasonable screen reader been built into that, and screen magnification for people who've got low vision. So if people know about this stuff, it's there if they need it. It's just knowing about it and how to use it, and the strategies and methods that a blind or partially sighted person would use to access that type of technology. I'm a blind person myself. I've used this technology for over 20 years, and so I'm able to lend that experience to people and discuss things that may not be strictly technical, but just methods of how to hunt for stuff on the internet. Okay, so you've got the computer speaking to you, or you've got large magnified so you can see it a bit better, but actually doing an internet search for something specific, you have to have certain strategies and methods and things like that. So it's all those kind of soft skills as well that people might use. And the other nice thing about having a training centre is that blind and partially sighted people manage to get together and discuss issues that may range beyond technology. Their emotional well-being, how they're managing in their daily life, just, you know, how to make a cup of tea and all those type of life skills that you need as a blind or partially sighted person just to survive. It's an opportunity for people just to get together. And so we have very generous tea breaks. People can just talk about whatever they want to and just network and get to know stuff. It means, you know, lovely interactions that we've noticed since we've been open. But the main thing is the technology, and they come along, we give them an assessment and ask them, you know, what is it you need to learn to improve your life? They sort of say, well, I really need to be able to use Skype. I had a lovely old story from a lady who's in her 80s, and she said, very Bristol she was, and do pardon my Bristol accent. Well, I had a computer, but it got stolen, so I thought I'd not bother her until I talked to my sister in Australia, who said, if I got a computer, I'd be able to talk to her on Skype. Well, yeah, okay. I think you probably mean Skype. But that was a lovely story. And so we got her down to come along. And the other thing that we offer as well is that we work with volunteers. And once people are finished in the centre, we don't just abandon them. We say, we'd like you to go home and use these skills at home. And we will give you support at home. One of our volunteers will come and visit you and support you in you know, maintaining those skills. Because what I've noticed in the years that I've been working in this area is that you can sit in a nice shiny training suite and teach people everything they need to know. But as soon as they're on their own and sitting in front of their computer at home, they kind of freeze. They become a bit kind of frightened of it. Things are not quite the same as it was at the training centre. And there's not that safety net of somebody hovering behind them to tell them what to do. So I think it's really important that we can go out and support them in their homes so that they're actually using these skills. Because though it's nice to learn things just for the sake of learning, this is real life skills that blind and partially sighted people can use to become more independent and less isolated, really. When I lost my sight back in 1974, the computers were simply big machines that were threatening everybody and going to take all our jobs and all that kind of thing. But as it's progressed, as we all know, it's become a really useful tool in people's lives. For example, when I lost my sight, if I wanted to know a simple question like, what's the capital of Peru or something, I would have to, if nobody in my immediate vicinity knew, I'd have to go down to the library and have somebody take me to the library, and we could go and look in an encyclopedia and look it up. You know, that's a half a day mission. Sure. I could go upstairs now and find that out in 10 seconds. And that's the kind of independence the information technology revolution has given blind and partially sighted people. And having access to that is, I believe, a human right. Well, if you want to find out more, you can go to our website, which is all the W's, actionforblindpeople.com. That's all one word, any case you like. Actionforblindpeople.org, O-R-G.uk. And on there, you'll be able to follow the links to the either the ICANN appeal or to the Action Technology Training Suite.
Scott Wood, Senior Technology Coordinator from Action for Blind People Training Centre. That report was by Kirsty Paul.
So we have with us Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill.
It's just over a year old now, so it's kind of a commemoration of the Occupy movement. You may remember last winter was in the news a lot. And this one, I went to see the occupiers when they were on College Green and read this to them. I found the conditions pretty grisly, really, I have to say. But they were making an interesting statement. Anyway, it's called Ode to the Occupiers. Bless the ones who take a stand against those who destroy our land and question what is being planned and see it not benign. But pity those who cannot think to read between the lines of ink and barely swim before they sink into long-term decline. Pity those who never learn and stand in queues to take their turn to borrow funds they can't return and dig in deeper debt. Pity those glued to their screens who always live beyond their means, addicted to their soapy scenes and courses others set. Pity those who are unemployed, whose way of life has been destroyed by something they could not avoid, and yet still have a go at redefining who they are while wishing on a tarnished star and covering their inner scar and going with the flow. Pity those who can't escape a life of economic rape, who cannot get their lives in shape or pass a simple test. Pity those who think they're free by being a celebrity, by basking in banality and end up just depressed. Pity Facebook's generation who seek fake friends in desperation, complying with their degradation through their soulless quest. Pity those without a hope, the overwhelmed who cannot cope, the cast adrift without a rope, the terminally oppressed. Pity those who seek romance, yet never dare to take a chance. They watch celebrities who dance, but never dance themselves. Pity them, and pity us who see all this and curse, who could but do not make a fuss, because we do not care. But bless the ones who take a stand against those who destroy our land and question what is being planned and see it's not benign. Bless those who say enough's enough, who sometimes call the tyrant's bluff and don't kowtow when life gets tough, but paint a warning sign. Bless those known as the occupiers, who challenge all the corporate liars and act as modern-day town criers, denouncing what's malign, whose occupation makes us think why all that's good appears to shrink. And as we hover on the brink, they paint their warning signs.
Thank you very much. That's very emotive.
Emotive, yes.
Definitely. And that's, I think, very significant. If the Occupy movement had been summed up to me quite like that, I think I probably would have understood it a bit quicker.
Right.
Do you think it was an effective movement?
I think it was effective, yeah, in terms of raising the consciousness of mainstream opinion, really. And a lot of people, whilst they would, I guess, like myself, when I actually went to see them, and I see they're living in fairly squalid conditions, which I wouldn't survive because I like my central heating and all that sort of comforts. But the idea of it, the sort of things they were talking about, it was much more. There wasn't the hostility that you would expect, you know, given they are very much on the sort of fringe of society. But a lot of people did sympathise with them, I think, and see that, you know, because of the grotesque dysfunctions of our present socioeconomic system, I think so much is just utterly malfunctioned and becoming increasingly so, that make us think and raise us consciousness on these, particularly with to do with the economic crisis and all that stuff, really.
It's an interesting time to do it as well, because they certainly didn't choose the warmest or easiest time of the year either. I used to go past the Occupy guys in Finsbury Square in London and knew of a few people that are outside St Paul's as well. It's it was a very connected network of people, wasn't it? Yes, it feels like a much quieter year this year.
Well, there's other stuff going on. Well, endless sex scandals, apparently. But,
well, that's grist for the mill, isn't it?
Rather tedious, really.
Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski. The producer, Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And me, Kay Sangandaffy.
And goodbye from me, James Amelia.
Until next week, goodbye.